If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Are you keeping tabs on the Brian Koberger appeal?
Yeah, I've been following it pretty closely, I'd say.
So he put forward a handwritten petition asking the court to let him withdraw his guilty plea. I didn't even know if that was even... Is that even possible?
I mean, it shouldn't be, but he's actually using a legal loophole, which is really quite interesting. When you plead guilty to a crime, there are different levels of pleading guilty. So you can offer an unconditional guilty plea. You can offer a conditional guilty plea. You can do something called an Alford plea where you plead.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, you plead guilty but maintain your innocence.
Yep.
So Brian Koberger pled guilty non-conditionally, which means he and he actually explicitly waived all his rights to appeal. So your question is, how can he even do this? And the answer is he can't. He can't appeal his guilty plea. He can't appeal anything, any of the evidence. He can't appeal the trial. What he's doing is he's appealing the plea itself. So he's using a legal loophole that's unique to Idaho. It's kind of in Canada, we have this thing called the Faint Hope Clause. It is somewhat similar in that it allows inmates who are convicted to submit an appeal to resolve a great injustice, basically.
Right. And he called out the judge basically for comments that and I think the judge's name is Judge Kipler. He said the judge called him, I think, a faceless coward. And so that was one of the things that he used.
Yeah, and that's the interesting part. A lot of the things in that handwritten document he submitted will not be considered, although the judge is considering his plea. So what will happen next is that he is appealing his plea. So what he is saying is that he entered his guilty plea under false pretenses.
Yeah, he said that the defense team was not really ready for trial and pressured him into it.
Right. So he's saying the plea itself is invalid. Therefore, so he like, as I said, he can't appeal anything to do with the trial. He can only appeal the plea itself. So he's saying the plea itself is invalid. So what will happen is this goes before a judge. The judge has read the plea, has taken it up, has set a date.
Next June. Takes almost a whole year.
Yeah. So he'll go through this process before a judge. And ultimately, this judge will decide if his plea is valid or invalid, if they get that far. The judge may just throw it out at some point.
I think the prosecution has an opportunity to try to have it thrown out as well.
They've already tried and it's been denied. So it will now go before a judge. Now, how far it will go before this judge is up is very questionable. It may not get very far, but it will go before a judge. And ultimately, the judge will either dismiss the case or decide whether the plea was valid or invalid. The interesting thing is that if the judge decides that the plea is invalid, that doesn't mean Koberger gets to go home. If the judge determines the plea is invalid, then everything just continues on as if he didn't plead guilty, meaning the indictment still stands, he still has to stay in prison, he's still charged with all these crimes, all the evidence submitted by the state is still good.
So what does it all mean then?
It means they would have to, I don't know if they would just continue on with the trial. I actually looked this up in Idaho law. The way it reads, it seems that if his plea was thrown out, the trial would just essentially restart, but everything they've done still counts.
Wow.
And it just kind of restarts as if he didn't end it and plead guilty, like he doesn't benefit from pleading guilty. But I would imagine in practical terms, they would actually restart the trial because he can't just bring the jury back.
Yeah.
So I'm not exactly sure, but the point is, is even if he's successful, he is not exonerated. He doesn't get to go home. And the prosecution could then seek the death penalty.
Oh.
And I assume okay. would.
Yeah.
So he doesn't necessarily win even if he wins.
Okay.
So okay. It's a novel legal strategy. He's using this loophole to even just get in back into court. He's got himself an out-of-state attorney now. But it seems, you know, it has shades of Clifford Olson did this a lot. It has shades of, you know, the Happy Face Killer did this a lot. This is a thing you see with these men who they get into prison. And then, and especially now in the social media age, he has this following and now he's going to torment his victims.
Yeah, he also included that, you know, the defense team kind of scared him into like what death row might look like for him.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't know that that's grounds to, I mean, when you go into the Idaho law, the only thing the judge can determine is that there was a grave misjustice. I forget the exact word they use, but it essentially says that the judge has to find that this was a complete injustice and that therefore the trial essentially restarts.
Right.
But, you know, his misunderstanding what prison would be like is not a grave injustice. Right. I mean, even, and you know, the things he's listed in
his appeal. He realized it kind of sucks and he doesn't want to be there. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And also he's bored.
Yeah.
You know,
so he's got, yeah, lots, you know, of time to think about this.
People ask me sometimes, you know, because I've spoken to a lot of serial killers, they say, how do you get these guys to talk to you? And that's one of the answers. They're bored.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not the Gary Ridgways of the world or the kind of very infamous serial killers.
Right.
I mean, but for the most part, they're pretty bored. Prison sucks. Like, they're not doing a lot.
Yeah.
In prison.
Yeah. Yeah. You just want to pass the day doing, you know, answering all your fan mail.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's get to some viewer comments for the week. We released the episode on Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker.
Yeah, and it's great. That episode is finding a lot of traction overnight. We just released it on Wednesday, and I just love it. I love it when people engage with our episodes like that and give us good feedback, and I love it. It's
great. Yeah, a lot of the comments in the RSS feed especially are like, Richard Ramirez, for a lot of people in the comments, is the scariest person that you could ever even imagine. And I guess the question is why?
Yeah, there was a lot of comments I saw talking about his victim profile.
Yeah.
So, you know, and yep. And I remember this is something I spoke with Dr. Johnston about.
Yeah, she was great.
And I remember she said something to the effect of, you know, he had this wide-ranging victim profile in terms of age, because his first victim was a small...
And gender too, right?
Yeah, and gender, because his first victim was a small child, and then his second victim was elderly, and there's women and there's men. And I, to your point, I think that is one of the things that makes him very, very scary, is that he didn't have a victim profile.
Right.
That he was almost purely about opportunity.
Sure.
And I think the way to think of Ramirez, which is what makes him scary, is you hear men like Cottingham, Berkowitz, Ridgway, Gacy, they talk about, they all call it something different. I remember Gacy called it cruising. Rifkin had a different term for it.
I remember he was just driving,
and
just to kill the time too.
Yeah, and what these guys do is they get in their car and they just drive aimlessly for
looking
hours.
For an opportunity,
and it's
right?
really mundane. It's really boring, but they're just looking for that perfect opportunity. That perfect opportunity. Now with Berkowitz, Ridgway, well, maybe not so much with Ridgway, but Gacy, Rifkin, they had a victim profile. They were looking for a certain type of woman.
Yeah.
Or young boy in Gacy's case. But with Ramirez, what is really scary about him is he isn't looking for a person. He's only looking for opportunity. He's looking for an open window. He's looking for a woman living alone. He's looking for an elderly couple who can't fight back.
They're like easy prey, right?
Yeah. And that's all he's looking for. And that to me is even scarier, because that means his victim pool is so much larger.
Yeah, right.
You know,
yeah, really nobody's safe, right?
Yeah.
I found his eyes were like the scariest thing for me. It just felt like there was just nothing behind them at all.
Yeah.
Like, and he was just looking right through you.
Looking right through you. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, then there's the Satanism aspect that he plays up a lot.
Which everybody was afraid of in the 80s, especially. I know,
yeah.
I was.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Haley Bailey. Okay, I need to tell you about something. I just got YouTube Premium.
It's got tons of awesome features like offline downloads, so I can download my favorite videos before I travel and watch them whenever I don't have Wi-Fi. Because we all know airplane Wi-Fi is the worst. I get ad-free, I get background play, and there's like a ton more in there. You should try it. If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Try it now for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium.
If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
By law, 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I remember the. Do you remember the Satanic Panic?
Of course
Panic?
I do. Yeah.
You remember like living through it?
Yeah, 100%. I do. Yeah, yeah, and all the talk shows about it. Like, Donahue had like. I remember watching like a Donahue episode, and it was like, oh my, this could happen to me.
I remember the Geraldo Rivera episode.
Right.
That's the one that sticks out to me. And there was it was Bob Berdella. Bob Berdella was in the Geraldo episode. If you've ever watched it, I mean, you can probably go back and watch it on YouTube, but Geraldo did this, it was an NBC special. He did this 1 hour special on Satanism in the 80s, which just kind of come to define the Satanic Panic. And they feature Bob Berdella in that episode, which is ironic.
That's right. I have seen that.
And that's ironic because Bob Berdella
had
nothing to do with Satanism. And actually this came up a lot in his confession. And I remember—
Doesn't he confront Berdella like in a hallway of a jail or something like that? Geraldo does?
Yeah, because—
I remember that part. And wasn't Berdella like beat it?
Yeah, that's right. And if you remember when we went to Kansas City, okay, hold on. I'm going to catch up the audience just in case. Bob Berdella, in case you haven't watched the Bob Berdella episode.
You should. It's a two-parter.
Bob Berdella was a serial killer in the 80s in Kansas City. He exclusively preyed on men. They called him Bizarre Bob because he had a shop called
Bob's Bizarre Bazaar,
which was a bazaar in the Westport Flea Market in Kansas City.
Now you can get a pretty good burger there. Sidebar.
Right. So in the 80s, this really bizarre man named Bob Berdella, he would lure young men back to his home. He would inject them with animal tranquilizers that he'd bought for his dog, and he would hold them captive in an upstairs bedroom for weeks. And he did this many, many times. So when we went to Kansas City and met the detective, he told us that when in the 1980s, when Geraldo was filming that special, Geraldo came to Kansas City and started showing up at the police station and started confronting the officers because he wanted to kind of expose the satanic element of Bob Berdella. And he became a nuisance in Kansas City. And they all had these memories of Geraldo trying to chase them through the hallways. And the irony of the whole situation was that Bob Berdella had nothing to do with Satanism. The only connection was that Bob Berdella was a massive collector. His house was hoarded out. He collected all sorts of antique goods. And one of the things he collected was antique artwork. And so he was fascinated in like African and Wiccan kind of pieces of art. He was an atheist. Bob Berdella talked about this extensively in his confession. He was an atheist. He didn't believe in Satanism.
But it was the time, right?
Yeah. But so in his windows, he had some of this art, and Geraldo, or a producer for Geraldo, saw this art and put it together and said, oh, Bob Berdella is
satanic.
These
are the signs,
And then they ran with that.
Okay, so let's move on to the Ed Kemper episode, which has been out for a couple of weeks. I'd like to thank Linda Schubert, who submitted a comment, and she mentioned that I'm struck by the fact that many of his victims were picked up and murdered in pairs. Could there be a connection in his mind to his two sisters who he probably resented?
I hadn't considered that, but that's quite insightful. I think probably. I mean, I have never read that, but when you think about it, it makes complete sense. I'm trying to run through the scenarios in my mind, and you know, when you think about it, yeah, he often, you know, would pick up one woman and then drive up the road and pick
right.
up another.
That's right.
I think there's a practical reason for this. One, in that if you're in the 1970s on a college campus and you're able to pick up a female hitchhiker and you're a 7-foot monster of a man,
right?
If you keep driving up the road, it's much easier to pick up a second hitchhiker
when you've already got somebody in the car.
Exactly,
it feels safer
yeah.
for them.
So I think
right.
I think there's an opportunity component to it,
right?
But psychologically, yeah, he had two sisters.
You don't hear too much about his sisters. The only thing that I had ever heard that he had an okay relationship with them, but I don't know if all of his anger seemed to be focused in on his mom. But
definitely. But he did speak about fantasizing about killing his mother and his sisters from a young age. We know that the victims were often, in his eyes, seen as surrogates for his mother. I think it's completely reasonable to think that... murdering young women in pairs reflected some sort of psychological surrogacy for his sisters. I think that's perfectly reasonable. I'm going to look into it more. I think that's a great, great insight.
We have another comment from Mystics Kexis 7459, and they write, "Have you read John Ronson's The Psychopath Test by chance? If you haven't, I think you would really enjoy it. He goes into depth about Robert Hare and the history involved in creating the checklist, among other things. John Ronson is also just enjoyable to read. He manages to inject humor into a topic that, frankly, isn't very funny. My understanding of psychopathy was really improved after reading this book."
I have not read this book. I saw this comment. This is from one of our members on YouTube. And if you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is to join our YouTube membership portal, which is now open. So thank you, Mystics Kexist 7459. Thank you very much for the comment. I have put the book on my TBR because I saw this comment and I'm interested to reading it. Robert Hare is still alive. He's relatively local to us. We've reached out to him to see if we can speak to him on the show. I don't know that he does interviews anymore. Although when we were speaking to Dr. Kent Keel,
yeah.
he said he's still publishing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Robert Hare is what, 90 or 91 years old? He
yeah.
lives in Vancouver, I think.
Yeah. So we're trying to book him for the show. I don't know if he's up for it, but we're trying.
We should go see him.
If he says yes, we will go see him.
I love it.
But I have not read this book. I'm going to read it. An interesting sidebar about the psychopathy checklist, and just in case you didn't hear that episode, I will bring you up to speed. The way that clinicians diagnose psychopathy, at least in like prison or in a formal clinical setting, is they use a tool called the PCLR, which stands for Psychopathy Checklist, and then the R stands for revised, because it's
right.
it was developed.
It's fairly short too, isn't it?
It's generally 20 questions, and the questions are not simple yes or no answers. They're 20 assessment questions, and you get a score of 0, 1, or 2 on each question, and then that gives you a number out of 40 at the end.
Yeah, this one right? came up in the Ed Kemper episode, and he had a 25?
He had a 26. So generally, they say anything above, I think the number is 22, is considered to be some version of psychopathy. That number fluctuates. But the reason we have this test is if someone is arrested for murder and they are suspected to be a psychopath, a judge will often order them to be assessed. And the clinician, among other things, will use this checklist
right.
to determine if this person is a psychopath. And if they are a psychopath, then their sentence may be harsher because the chance of committing another violent act increases
yeah.
if you're a psychopath. At least that's what the science tells us. The interesting sidebar to this is there is new research that is suggesting that the PCLR is much more biased than we thought, meaning that the questions are too subjective and that offenders are often judged to be psychopaths based on preconceived ideas of the tester versus what is actually reality in their life. So this research is suggesting that the PCLR is not near as reliable as we have thought in the past.
And the PCLR has been around for a while, though.
It's been around for decades.
Yeah.
And so there is new research bringing it into question. Now, that is not to say that the PCLR is completely invalid or that we should stop using it. But this new research has raised questions as to how much we should rely on it. And I think the underlying problem is that we have a poor definition of psychopathy. There's disagreement on what a psychopath even is. And until we kind of, and the reason there's disagreement on what a psychopath is because our understanding of human consciousness is incomplete. Our understanding of-
it's evolving, right?
Yeah, we know a ton about neuroscience, a lot to even make predictions, but we still don't understand the fundamental nature of human consciousness. And fundamentally, we don't quite understand how decisions are made in their totality.
Right. Okay. Recently, we released an episode on Bruce MacArthur. Maybe a quick synopsis for those who don't know who Bruce MacArthur is, just because you've been part of this project for quite a while.
I've been following the footsteps of Bruce MacArthur for years now,
right.
Since what, 2020?
Yeah, right.
Bruce MacArthur was a serial killer in Toronto, Canada. I highly encourage you. So I really like the episode we put out on him.
Yeah,
we put out an episode a couple of weeks ago where we went to Toronto. He was a serial killer in Toronto in the 2000s, kind of 2008 era. And over many years, he was closeted for many years, and then he came out. He was gay, and he was a landscaper, and he was often frequented the gay village, which is a two-block little community in Toronto, Ontario. And he would go to the gay village, and he would find usually South Asian men, usually immigrants.
Right.
He would recruit them to his landscaping company, and then he would kill them, and then he would dismember their remains, and he put their remains in the pots of and the backyards
clients.
Of clients. Yeah.
Right.
It was mostly one client, but there was evidence found in multiple locations. But that's what made the story so kind of sensational, was that that is a pretty sensational aspect, the
right.
idea that he was putting these remains in the potted plants of
absolutely. And
rich people.
One of the things that I thought I knew the story until we did the full episode, I didn't realize, or I had never heard the story before, of them having lunch amongst the planted pots. And then he would kind of position them around them as like totems.
Yeah. So when I originally covered this story, we made a documentary called Catching a Serial Killer, Bruce MacArthur, which is on Amazon and
Crave in Canada.
And when we went to Toronto, we went to the backyard where they found the majority of the remains. And it's a suburb of Toronto. It looks like a suburb. I mean, it's really a nice suburb, big homes. They're not mansions, but they're nice houses.
It's like upper middle class neighborhood, right?
Upper middle class, yeah. Driveways, long driveways, big backyards.
Like mature trees and lots of separation between the houses.
Yeah, it's a really nice community. So we went up there. The homeowner invited us. We went up there. And the backyard is actually the home where he buried a lot of the men, a lot of his victims, is not, it's kind of a cottage style home, I would say.
It's pretty private, isn't it?
Yeah, it's private for sure. It's on the corner. It backs onto a ravine, so there's no one behind it. There's no one to one side. And when you go in the backyard is actually relatively small for this area. And he would, and it's surrounded by a garden, and it has a lot of potted plants. The pots are big. They're those big, like...
They're like 3 or 4 feet across, right?
Yeah, those big pots. And the homeowner explained to me, what he would do is at lunchtime, he would pull a picnic table into kind of the middle of the yard,
mm-hmm.
and he would take these pots, which we now know contain the remains of his victims. They didn't know it at the time, obviously. And he would take these big pots, and he would have his landscaper crew, and they would move these pots into a circle to create this like lunch area. And everyone thought, oh, this is really nice. He's celebrating.
Right.
Nature and but now we know that he was actually moving the remains of his victims around him, encircling him and his crew.
Okay.
While he would eat lunch.
That's a great lead into the question, and this comes from socially patterned defect 9580. And they ask, well, how did those planters not stink?
So, I mean, that's a very good question. And there is a lot of elements about the MacArthur case that we just simply don't know. For example, he lived on the 19th floor and he had a roommate. And it is believed that he did some of the dismemberment in his bathroom. We know that a lot of the murders took place there. But no one has ever, you know, no blood was ever found. We don't exactly know where he did the dismemberment and how he got it out of his apartment building, or if he did it offsite at another location that has never been discovered, or if he did it maybe in the ravine. It's just unclear,
right,
like exactly where this took place.
Okay.
When the police took the remains out of the planters, they were wrapped in plastic. So that would have contained the smell of the, when they retrieved the remains out of the ravine, they were inside like a, Rubbermaid kind of.
Like a tote?
Yeah, like a Rubbermaid tote. And then that was placed inside like one of those big rain barrels. So it was packaged, significantly.
Right.
So that would have mitigated the smell, but I would suspect that people did smell things and it was just written off as fertilizer or refuse.
Right.
I mean, that's the evil genius about having a landscaping company as a serial killer. If you think about it, I mean, landscapers always have refuse. They're working with their hands, so they're dirty. That, you know, you don't look twice at a landscaping van in your neighborhood. You know, you can move
freely.
You're almost invisible.
Right.
No one asks you any questions. You know, it is a really good business if your goal is he was able to recruit his victims to work there because you could pay everybody under the table. So it's a really good business if that's your goal, is to hide what you're doing.
And hiding in plain sight was like, that kind of sums it up for Bruce MacArthur, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, how many times have you seen a landscaping van by your house? Like, all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not something you would blink an eye at, especially if you live in a suburb.
Yeah, 100%.
You know?
Okay. Last question. I wanted to just preface this by saying, do you have any idea of what episode has produced the most comments?
No. Well, I have no idea. You're asking me if I know. No, I have no idea. Yeah. That's I'm interested to know.
Israel Keys.
Really?
Yeah. So
Israel Keys.
Israel Keys, a little bit of backstory here before I get to the question.
I should have guessed. I would have guessed Ted Bundy.
Hmm. Yeah, that's fair.
Israel Keys. The backstory in Israel Keys, from Alaska, another modern era serial killer. And he basically had a lifelong project in which he would go around the country and find random people, strangers, and kill them and take great lengths, great pains to cover his tracks, moving between states.
Burying
caches of guns.
That he might not
get
to.
Years in advance,
yeah.
Right? He did all these really... He really was like, if you kind of think of a Jason Bourne type person, that's how he saw himself, and he spent his life, you know, carrying out these secret missions that he was assigning himself that were, you know, targeting people and killing people. I mean, it's awful. And his downfall was murdering a barista near his home, which was caught on video, and that was his downfall. And he was then captured and then brought back to Alaska. I should also mention he didn't exclusively kill people. He robbed banks. He did all sorts of stuff.
Right. So this question is at the end of Israel Keys' story,
mm-hmm.
he commits suicide while incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is how in this modern world is that even possible?
Well, it happens. I think in this case, the authorities in Alaska had no idea what they were dealing with. It took them months to realize what they were dealing with. And even then, they didn't really fully understand it till after he died.
I wonder if we even understand it now fully. Like, we probably never will, right?
I would never say never, but yeah, I take your point that we still don't fully understand it. I think there's a lot of, first of all,
just from all the ground that he covered, like he was all over America.
Well, there's a lot here. I mean, first of all, if you speak with Maureen Callahan about this, and she is the foremost expert on this case, she wrote the book American Predator. You know, she talks about the FBI, you know, from her perspective, and I don't want to put words in her mouth, but she believes that there is a lot more to this case that the FBI knows and is just not telling us, which is very possible. I mean, for investigative reasons, but also just because they don't want to admit, you know, so I think that there could be a future,
right,
10 years from now, 20 years from now, where we get the Israel Keys files.
Right.
And, you know,
yeah, maybe
we get more insight. So I think that's one reason. What I was saying about Alaska, and I really, I mean, speaking with Mary Rook, who's the special agent in charge of Alaska, she was in our Israel Keys.
Yeah, she was incredible.
Incredible. I don't fault her or the agents. I really think they were doing an earnest job. And I really think they tried. I think they got what they could out of it. I think the interrogation of him, I mean, the interrogation was sabotaged by the prosecutor. This is a whole nother story. Mm-hmm. That we don't actually get into the episode. I will tell it to you very quick because it's a long story. The prosecutor in Alaska was way out of his depth. When Israel Keys was caught, they brought him back to Alaska and they notified the FBI. Mary Rook was in charge of the FBI. She was the special agent in charge of Alaska.
Of the state, yeah.
And there was a couple of investigators brought up to interrogate Israel Keys. The prosecutor in Alaska, the state prosecutor, he was also had jurisdiction over the case, and he insisted on being in the room.
In the room, right.
During the interrogations, which is a terrible idea. Because, for one, if he is sitting questioning Israel Keys in the room, he then becomes a witness to his own case. So, right off the bat, bad idea, legally. Second, he had no idea how to talk to a psychopath. He did not know what he was doing, and he shut down many, many lines of inquiry that would have given us more insight into Israel Keys. So his confession in terms of the FBI was actually handled pretty well, but it was sabotaged by the prosecutor in Alaska. So to your point, there is huge holes in the Israel Keys case. Will we ever know the truth? I think that the FBI knows a lot more than they're saying. You know, at least that's what Maureen Callahan says, and I defer to her. She's the expert.
Right.
And I think, you know, things will come to light over time.
The one thing that I found interesting about that is that he was locked in his cell at 9:30 p.m., and he wasn't discovered until 5:57 a.m. the next morning.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to, again, I guess this is what I was trying to say about the prosecutor. It speaks to they were out of their depth. You know, the Alaska authorities were out of their depth. Despite the FBI's intervention, they didn't know how to deal with Keys. They didn't know how to talk to him. They didn't know how to watch him. They didn't realize how dangerous he was. And he ultimately was able to kill himself because they weren't watching him closely enough.
Right. Okay. So if you have a question that you want us to answer, I'd like you to leave it in the comments on YouTube or Apple Podcasts. Or better yet, DM us on Instagram at Unmarked Podcast, or you can hit up Buddy directly at James Buddy Day.
That's it.
Thanks for listening.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAP sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked, board-certified plastic surgeons, from tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond. Every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
You know what quality feels like. You can see it in the way a fabric moves, recognize it in a flawless fit, and appreciate it in the details that make our styles unique. It's the standard Coldwater Creek has honored for over 40 years, derived from a rich Mountain West heritage and designed for today in styles that are distinctively Coldwater Creek. For a wardrobe you can count on season after season, visit coldwatercreek.com. Shop new arrivals and save 15% on purchases $75 or more with code IHEART.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at chumbacasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.